Next case up this morning is Silverwing Development versus Nevada State Contractors Board. Counsel, if you'd come up. All right, we've got this. We had granted a motion for one of the MIKI to argue, so we allowed 5 minutes to MIKI. So we've added an additional 5 minutes to Mr. Kimmel's arguments. So we've got Mr. Kimmel with 20 minutes and Mr. Allison at 15 minutes and Mr. Manelli at 5 minutes. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, wonderful. Counselor, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
All right, come on up. And for the record, this is docket 79134.
Your Honor, if I could, I would like to reserve 7 minutes for reply since I have amici and other arguments.
Sure.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Kimmel. I'm with the law firm of Hoyt, Christinger, Kimmel, Vallis. I represent appellants J. Carter Witt III and Silverwing Development. I'd like to start with a few examples. The small landscaper who year after year goes to a home, plants flowers, plants trees for individual homeowners, is now likely violating the law. The remodel contractor who over the course of years or decades goes out to a home and remodels rooms or remodels bathrooms is now likely violating the law. The plumber who lawfully does the original plumbing on a single house in a subdivision would now likely violate the law if they went out and did work on any other house in that same subdivision. Developers can no longer rely on historical performance and relationships. Now they have to get thrown into the unknown. That's now the law, according to the Nevada State Contractors Board. We're here before this court because a particular phrase in the statute, in 624.220 sub 2, quote, on a single construction site or subdivision site for a single client. There's no statutory definition of that phrase anywhere. The board has never promulgated any regulations that give guidance as to what a site is. There's no even internal memoranda within the board that defines when that will apply. So appellants contend four issues. That 624.220 sub 2 is unconstitutionally vague, violating due process. That the board's prior attempts to create some rules were in violation of the non-delegation doctrine. That 624.220 sub 2 violates equal protection because different licensees with same monetary limits are treated differently based on where and for whom they do their work. And finally, that there was not substantial evidence supporting the administrative law judge's determination that my client's projects were subdivision sites. So I'll talk about each in turn. Due process. We've raised both facial and as applied challenges. This court in Nelson v. State said that a statute will be deemed to have given sufficient warning as to prescribed conduct when the words utilized have a well-settled and ordinary understood meaning when viewed in the context of the entire statute. The phrase is very important because it separates out the distinction between ambiguity and vagueness. Ambiguity exists where there is no context. But once words are placed in context, if they still require some sort of subsidiary set of rules to understand what they mean, then we have transcended ambiguity and gone into vagueness.
Don't we have a whole set of rules of statutory interpretations for the specific purpose of interpreting an ambiguous statutory provision?
Yes.
Okay, and so if we use those, we can't do that because it's vague?
No, that's not my point, Your Honor. My point is that there are circumstances where even utilizing those rules of statutory construction, it still does not get you to the end where you understand what what the particular phrase means, even placed in the context of the statute that it's in, and even using those rules of statutory construction.
Thank you.
Stated another way, vagueness exists when there's no clear meaning to a word or phrase. And so the only way you can determine what it is to utilize some sort of subsidiary rules. And sometimes it is through those other statutory constructs of interpretation. Other times it might be through clarifying statutes or clarifying regulations. This point, this important point, is reflected in the very actions of the board in this case. The board's investigator, Jeff Gore, unequivocally, without any hesitation, testified that there was absolutely no statute that he could look at, no regulation, no administrative code, no internal or external memorandum, nothing that he could look at to determine if something was a single construction site or subdivision site. That's in 4A App 904-906. That testimony actually took the administrative law judge aback a bit. And His Honor Judge Prost stepped in and actually asked a question. Just to make sure I do understand, are there any other written guidelines you have, manuals, guidebooks, things that you have that you employ to make those determinations as to construction sites, subdivision site? Without hesitation, Mr. Gore answered no. So Mr. Gore is left solely with his own personal experiences. That's it. But we can't even analyze what those experiences are. This court cannot issue an opinion that reflects those proverbial Gore factors, if you want to call them that, because we don't know what they are. The board's own counsel, Mr. Allison, in a 2015 opinion letter to Tesla, came up with a six-factor test.
Can I ask, going back to, gnawing at me, you had mentioned that Mr. Gore hadn't come up with a definition at all. And my understanding was this was remanded to the hearing officer for a clarification as to his definition of subdivision site. And my understanding was that the clarification essentially deferred to Mr. Gore's interpretation of what the subdivision site means. Is that incorrect?
No, that is correct, Your Honor.
Can you explain that to me just a little bit?
Certainly. The district court judge sitting on petition for judicial review believed that there was an inconsistency or something that the district court didn't understand about the ALJ's opinion.
Right.
And it had to do with almost the circular nature of site, mm-hmm. subdivision site, but then also having the statutory definition of subdivision. To be a subdivision, you must have five or more sites. So we get into this circle of, is a site a singular thing? Is it a bigger thing? And the district court had some concerns about that and remanded that issue back to the administrative law judge for clarification. And in essence, Judge Pro said that, well, sometimes words don't mean the exact same thing, and I relied on the officer, the actual investigative officer, for his determination as to whether this was a subdivision site or not.
But didn't Mr. Gore's testimony pertain to a construction site instead of a subdivision site? And is it appropriate to defer to Mr. Gore's testimony?
With respect to the first question, Your Honor, the testimony, I go through a long series of questions with Mr. Gore, mm-hmm. specific to construction site, and then I finish up by asking him, and if we were to go through the same type of analysis with respect to subdivision site, in terms of, can you look to anywhere? What are you using for guidance?
Okay.
He articulates that it would be the same result.
Okay, I understand.
And I'm sorry, I forgot the second part of...
As far as deferring to his interpretation of subdivisions.
Understood. I understand, Your Honor, the desire sometimes to rely on the Chevron doctrine and to grant a lot of deference to an administrative body in interpreting its own statutes. But that deference cannot be without bounds. We have a situation here where the public and licensees have to have a fair opportunity to follow the law. They are entering into contracts. They are submitting bids. They are hiring people. They have to have a fair opportunity to understand what the law means and how it will be applied. And when we're dealing with a situation where nobody knows what that is, and it could quite literally change investigator to investigator, just because Mr. Gore uses the Gore factors, whatever those may be, that doesn't mean that Mr. Smith is going to use the Gore factors or Mr. Smith.
Is there any evidence that somebody else has interpreted it differently or that some other investigator wouldn't think that your client had violated this statute?
Your Honor, there's actually no evidence in the record before this court that this statute has ever been applied this way, ever.
Or is there evidence it's been applied a different way?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
At some point, there could be administrative regulations that were created to provide definitions. They can do that, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I do believe that it is certainly within the powers that have been granted by the legislature to the administrative body to promulgate regulations that help it enforce and apply existing statute. But that has not occurred in this case.
Well, counsel, so the word subdivision site, or the words subdivision site, so there's the board's interpretation, as I understand it, says that that refers to the entire subdivision, right? And I guess an alternative interpretation is that subdivision site refers to each unit, if you will, that gets subdivided within the subdivision. Is there some other alternative interpretation of subdivision site besides those two possibilities?
Your Honor, I think I would fine-tune it just a bit, and here's how. First, we have to remember that we don't even get to this subdivision in the context that it's being used unless we step out of 624 and go over to 278 and borrow that statutory definition of subdivision. That statutory definition of subdivision isn't referenced.
I didn't reference it, I don't think.
Okay. And so then more directly on point, there are other ways. The building departments define what they believe the site to be. They do so by requiring permits. They require payment for application of permits. They require payment for utilities, payment and applications for sewer, individual inspections, and separate certificates of occupancies and final inspections. By way of example, in this particular case, the uncontested facts are that each one of my client's buildings had separate permits, separate applications, separate utilities, separate fees paid, separate inspections, and separate certificates of occupancy.
Okay. So you think the words subdivision site in 624.220 sub 2, that can reasonably be interpreted to mean a building?
I think the word site, Your Honor, is singular, and it implies a singular thing, a singular specific thing.
Yes.
It's used both with respect to subdivision, and it's used also in the part of the sentence that is construction. And I do believe that those are a reference to a specific place. We know that because further on in 624, we actually have the situation through which the contractors board can look at a licensee and say, guess what, licensee? I'm going to aggregate your open work across sites, plural. That's where it's used for the purposes of meaning something more than just one.
Right. So you think it means one building?
I think that it is, I believe that it is vague. I believe that if there is a reasonable interpretation to infer into the language, it has to be one that is consistent with what our municipal building departments and county building departments do with respect to issuing permits.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting that the statute itself uses site in two different contexts. It identifies a construction site, and it identifies a subdivision site, which, using those terms in the same sentence, suggests to me that they're intended to mean different things. A construction site is different from a subdivision site. Otherwise, I don't know why the legislature would use those differing terms in the same sentence.
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor, and unfortunately, we don't have legislative.
I still don't know how that helps us in identifying what a construction site consists of or what a subdivision site consists of. One could say that subdivision implies residential homes, as an example, just because of the way in which that word is used throughout 278. But I don't know what a construction site is, whether that's a building or multiple buildings or a commercial project as opposed to a residential project. These words, maybe this is the product of a 1967 statute, but these words don't seem to have any common usage that I know of. Now, ordinarily, for statutory interpretation, we would take a look at resources, Black's Law Dictionary. What are the common phrases for this? I'd like you to address that before you sit down as to why we wouldn't look at the definition in Black's or some other Webster's or other common references to define the term construction or define the term subdivision.
I think all counsel have actually attempted to some degree to do that. It's an imperfect exercise because we're not just taking a word, we're taking strings of words and putting them together. I agree with Your Honor that the first blush is to think, okay, well, one is a reference to commercial, the other is a reference to subdivisions, residential subdivisions. It begs the question of what do you do with the common area in that residential subdivision? Is that a construction site or is that a subdivision site? It is imperfect language for sure, Your Honor. What we do know is we can look elsewhere in the statute and we can see that the legislature didn't intend it to be a big thing. And the reason I say that, Your Honor, is because we have other very, very crystal clear examples of when the legislature intended something to be more encompassing than the singular idea of site. The key example is work of improvement. Within 624, which then borrows the actual definition from 108, we have a very expansive definition of work of improvement. It's the entire scheme of improvement as a whole. It's not limited to one site. So we have that definition in 624 of work of improvement. I contend that if the legislature had intended this aggregation to occur so broadly, it had a multitude of other ways to do that than by using a singular word like site.
Well, I'm pretty sure they didn't want a $10,000 limit on a carpet layer's license doing the MGM Grand remodel.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. But what's clear and what we're really talking about is that the heart of all of this is when do you start aggregating across multiple situations? That's the key that we're talking about here, Your Honor. If I could, I'd like to reserve what little time I have left. Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Noah Allison from the Allison Law Firm. I'm appearing on behalf of the Nevada State Contractors Board. I'm going to lead off and follow up on the discussion that we've been having. I want to talk about why do we require license limits from contractors? That goes right to the Equal Protection Clause arguments and to some extent the Due Process Clause arguments. We require those because we don't want, and one of our board members has used it very well. He says, we don't want to see contractors get out over their ski tips. We don't want to see contractors doing a job without the financial resources and then getting unable to pay their suppliers because someone up above them couldn't pay them. Happens all the time in construction. If you're a subcontractor, the general contractor goes bust or is slow paying, if you don't have the right limit, you can't weather that. And the same goes if you're a general contractor and the owner doesn't pay you. This concept has been with the construction board since 1945. We've been doing limits on licenses.
So let me ask you this, and I was just going to say, this has been around a long time. When my grandfather was a contractor, when my dad was a contractor, I mean, this goes back even as long as I can remember. Do you agree with your colleague that the legislature has granted to the board the ability to adopt regulations that would define or interpret these terms?
Absolutely.
Why hasn't the board done that in 70 years?
Because this is the first time we're here talking about it. I think the construction community, and you'll probably hear this from Amicus, pretty clearly understands what a single construction site is and what a subdivision site is. Mm-hmm. That's the way it's been done, and that's the way it's been handled since 1967. In 1963, the legislature first legislated license limits, and what they did is they said that you couldn't exceed a contract amount. Well, what happened after 1963 for those 4 years is you had contractors coming in wanting to build a 10-story hotel and entering into 10 separate contracts with the owner to build a hotel by each floor. You had subdivisions being built, and I do agree with you that a 1967 subdivision isn't a lot like a subdivision these days. They're very different concepts. And that's why we go to the, that's why we have regulations. That's why we go back to the legislature. That's why we change laws. We don't change laws here.
But why haven't you adopted a regulation that defined these terms? Why hasn't the board done that?
As I said, Your Honor.
You've initiated a fine, right?
Yes.
There's a penalty that this company has sustained.
Yes.
And that has a quasi-criminal concept to it.
Well, are we talking about, well, if we look at the handyman case, which is cited in the brief, if you're fining somebody and not taking away their license, that's not the kind of property deprivation that rises to anywhere beyond your basic rational basis look at the statute.
Mm-hmm. So you would argue there's no due process violation because of handyman?
Because of handyman, and also just because it's the statute is clear on its face, and it's very well understood. If you are a contractor, it cautions contractors against, I'm going to stick to subdivision site, Your Honor, because that's what Judge Pro stuck to, and I think under 233B135, that kind of draws the four corners around this. I'm not going to get into construction site.
You're arguing to us that it's clear on its face, but didn't the board in its advisory opinion in 2015 acknowledge that the language single construction site was ambiguous?
I said that, yes, Your Honor.
So you're saying something different today?
No, I'm talking about subdivision site here, Your Honor. I'm not talking about single construction site.
So construction site, that phrase is ambiguous.
I think,
but subdivision site is not.
That's my view, yes.
Oh, okay.
Now, let me ask you this in that regard. That's what was again gnawing at me earlier. What's the difference? The consensus seems to be there is no difference. What's your definition of a construction site as opposed to a subdivision site? And going back to the point I made earlier, sending this back to have it defined and clarified, and then deferral to Mr. Gore's interpretation of subdivision site, right?
Right.
But he didn't define subdivision site. He defined construction site. So now
all of a sudden it's they're different, but they're really not.
Okay, I'll start by explaining the difference.
That makes sense.
I think I do understand what you're saying, Your Honor. And I think let's start with the difference between a single construction site and a subdivision site. A single construction site, tends to be a commercial-based project. A single construction site would be the Tesla factory. It would be a hotel. It would be a place where there may be multiple parcels, there may be multiple permits, there may be multiple buildings, but overall the construction activity that's occurring is a single construction site. Construction projects come in all shapes and sizes. They have a great degree of variability, and I don't think you can exactly say a single construction site is any one thing, and that's why when I wrote the Tesla opinion, and that was restricted only to the Tesla matter, because that's what the board will give an opinion if you ask them for it, which could have been done here. We basically said, we're not going to answer your question, Tesla, whether what you're doing is a single construction site. We didn't answer that question. We said, these are the kinds of things we look at to help us reach that concept, and that would be temporal separation between construction activity, that would be geographic separation, that would be permitting separation. All of those things go into a mix, and you look at those things, because sometimes you might have buildings that are far apart, but they're being built at the same time, and it's part of the same construction.
You know, that kind of approach is not unlike or uncommon to what other administrative agencies do when they're dealing with a broad term in the statute. Department of Taxation, you can pick your favorite agency. They will adopt regulations that specify factors to be employed to determine whether a particular situation fits within that language as guidance. Here, LCB said, maybe so, but that is ad hoc rulemaking. You can't just use those factors without publishing them as regulations. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, I'm going to cite you a case, Gaming Commission versus GNLV Corp. Mm-hmm. That's 108 Nevada 456. And in that case, we had a situation where we were talking about the definition of a wager. And there's we can use that as an analogy, and we can say that a wager could be lots of different things. There could be a huge variance in what a wager is. And what this court said is it said when it's required to promulgate a regulation where regulatory action is taken to enforce or implement the necessary requirements of the existing statute. So in the absence of a regulation, and I agree there is an absence of that, but there's a place to go to get a regulation, and there's a process for that. And that could happen in the future. But when that is absent, an administrative agency is entitled to use its experience to define that term under those circumstances. A wager could be lots of different things. We can't say what it is. Now, and that was not ad hoc rulemaking. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Tesla was restricted to the facts.
I apologize. Can I get the citation again for that case?
Sure. 108 Nevada 456, 834 P. Second up 411. It's a 1992 case.
Thank you.
Did I answer your question, Your Honor?
Oh, yes, sir. I you're doing great, Mr. Okay. Allison. All counsel have been doing super. I mean, I'm glad you brought the issue here. I've been interested in this topic since I worked on construction sites with my okay. grandfather. So,
and I'm
it comes up a lot. That's
absolutely.
Why it's always surprised me that there have been no regulations that deal with this.
And I'm going to be candid here. I personally believe that is something that could happen, and that's something that maybe should happen. But we don't have one today. And the question we have here is this court going to do? Is it this court's role to do that? I don't think this court is entitled exercises judgment. It doesn't exercise its will against statutes. That's one of the Federalist Papers, I think. So now I can tell my wife
well,
I quoted Alexander Hamilton.
Just to be clear, I'm not sitting here as a justice on the Supreme Court advocating
right.
for the adoption of regulations through any opinion we publish. I'm not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is, what do we do in circumstances in which regulations appear to be appropriately called for. We're not adopted.
Right.
And now you have a party who's been fined under those regulations based on an interpretation by an investigator that is applied by him only.
And I'm going to respond to that. And this is going back to your point, Justice Paragar, because I didn't quite finish that response. And this is where Judge Pro wrote back and said, hey, you know, in response to the question from Judge Sattler saying, how did you decide whether a site, subdivision site, is the entire subdivision or whether it's a site within the subdivision? You're kind of left with only two things. It's either going to be the whole thing or it's going to be one of those little lots in the subdivision. There's nothing in the legislative history that says it could be. I mean, now you are making law and rulemaking and everything else when you sit there and say, well, it could mean the permitting qualification of the county board, and that there's nothing in the legislative history that says that. You got to put yourself in the mind of a 1967 senator and have him say, we said subdivision site because we have subcontractors out there with little bitty limits. They're building an entire subdivision from going right across 40 houses, and we have a general contractor that's hiring them and sending up a contract, one for each house. That is not going to protect the public, because if they have that little bitty limit and they're working on 10 different houses in the subdivision or 20 different houses in the subdivision at the same time for the same general contractor, you're going to have a problem. And that's why they made that rule. It was the entire subdivision site. And just something I wanted to point out, this is in the appendix, AAP, it's in I think it's the third volume, 682. These are the subdivision plats that were used to create these subdivisions. And every one of these plats that were created actually by Silverwing's people and then created, when they identify the subdivision, they draw the picture around the subdivision, and they have a great big sign here that says site, and it's got the whole subdivision blank grayed out. I think we could not find in my review of law nationwide anything where the phrase subdivision site meant anything other than the whole subdivision. So I don't think Mr. Gore is not a lawyer. Mr. Gore is an investigator. He's not going to sit there and have a legal definition for subdivision site in his pocket. That's for Judge Pro. That's for you.
So let me ask you that. Is it appropriate for the hearing officer to defer to Mr. Gore's definition then?
I don't think he did. I think what Judge Pro did is Judge Pro said, I have to decide, I have to resolve this ambiguity. I have to decide whether subdivision site means one or the other. How do I do that? I look at Mr. Gore's testimony where he's describing the activity that he views as violative that's occurring over there. And he said, I see buildings. I see things happening at the same time over different buildings. I see it's happening in the same area. These buildings are permitted by building, not by little bitty unit. And so he said, well, then because of what Mr. Gore is telling me, I now know that subdivision site means the whole thing. And I think that's
and
pretty
so
clear
anyway. And so effectively, didn't he ended up saying, no, I didn't rely on the definition in 278.320 because that uses the word site in a different way.
That used,
as to the word site.
Correct. This 278 definition defines the legal concept of a subdivision, which is land vacant or improved, divided into five or more lots, parcels, sites, plots. That's because the plat sometimes will say units, sometimes it will say parcels, sometimes it will say sites. When you say subdivision site, what you're doing is after you record a plat, then the legal concept of a subdivision becomes the real thing. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, Mr. Minnell.
Good morning. May it please the court. Phil Manley of McDonald Carano, and I have the honor of representing the Construction Trade Associations. Initially, we would like to thank the court for allowing us the opportunity to file an amicus brief and to participate in this in the oral argument today. The Construction Trade Associations comprise companies across the spectrum in the construction industry, including design professionals, subcontractors, suppliers, general contractors, and others. The contractor members have license limits of all different levels, including small limited licenses, unlimited licenses, and everything in between. This appeal and the license limit structure is very important to the Construction Trade Associations, our 1,200 plus member companies, the tens of thousands of employees and workers, the construction industry as a whole, and the state in general. With my limited time today, I would like to discuss the importance of the license limit structure, as well as the policy and the history behind it, and then maybe touch on a few of the questions that you have. The members of the Construction Trade Association have been advocating for the enforcement and creation of construction license limits since at least 1961. And the license limits have been enforced for nearly 60 years without major issues and in accordance with the board's standards of enforcement. The legislative history shows that contractors specifically requested the legislature enact rules to create guidelines to protect the public and the construction industry. And since enactment of these rules, the legislature, contractors, and the construction trade associations have been concerned with contractors attempting to evade these license limit rules. And the legislative history also shows that this statute has been amended during 9 different legislative sessions, and those amendments appear to be aimed at preventing evasion and closing loopholes by adding the specific language at issue in this appeal. And so basing license limits on a contractor's solvency and their financial strength is related to the stated purpose to protect the interests of the public and the construction industry. And the structure in place furthers that purpose. The limit is set at the amount that the contractor requests and their financial support. The system is in place to help ensure that the contractors do not become overextended and that they perform work within their competence and within their resources. Now, the license limit framework furthers that purpose because when a contractor is working at different projects or for different clients, the risk of non-payment or delayed payment are significantly less. If an owner or prime contractor doesn't pay or delays payment on one project, hopefully that contractor has the financial capability to still pay, make its payroll and to pay its suppliers based on its existing financial strength and the cash flow from the other projects.
Counsel, what in the statutory license limit, statutory language would guide the court in answering or interpreting the phrases at issue here?
Thank you, Your Honor. We agree that a reasonable interpretation of subdivision site means the physical location of a subdivision. Construction site means the physical location where the construction is occurring, and subdivision site means the physical location of a subdivision. There's no indication in the legislative history that the legislature intended it to mean anything different. And in fact, the phrase subdivision site must mean more than a single family home within a subdivision, because a single family home within a subdivision is in fact a single construction site. So if subdivision site also meant the single site within a subdivision, then those terms are now superfluous.
Maybe I didn't phrase my question adequately. I'm trying to determine whether there is direction in the statutes that establish the license limit requirements to help guide us in answering this question. For example, if the purpose of the license limit statutes are to assess an individual's financial capability.
Correct.
Then it would seem like, my hypothetical, that a carpet layer subcontractor who has a license limit of $10,000 was based on their financial strength, and you wouldn't want them working on the MGM hotel remodel, which calls for millions of dollars of carpet to be installed.
Correct. So the factors in the financial capability and the system as a whole contemplates that contractors are going to go out and they're going to seek, and may I finish, I see my time's up, may I finish my question?
Go ahead.
They're going to go out and they're going to seek as many projects as they can across different locations and for different clients. So the license limit that the board grants a licensee doesn't necessarily mean this is the amount we think that you could do on one single project if you put all of your resources into one project. It contemplates that contractors are going to go out and try to get different work and spread their risk, because the risk of having a contractor doing one project up to the maximum amount that they can is the whole reason that the license limits are in place, because if that happens and that owner or that prime contractor isn't paying the contractor or the subcontractor, then that subcontractor cannot pay its suppliers, that subcontractor cannot pay its employees, and it's likely going to fold. And that does not protect the public, and that does not protect the construction industry.
So if I may, Justice Perry-Gary, yes, ask one additional question. Mm-hmm. So it is odd to me that someone with a low limit license, 25,000, is usually a start-off number, as I understand it, would be able to do a single house remodel that fits within that limit, but then can also do 45 other house remodels at the same time, as long as they're within that limit. Is that how you interpret the statute?
That is how the statute is interpreted, and the whole purpose there is that the risk is spread across multiple projects, and so that subcontractor would have to have enough resources, manpower, supplies, trucks, equipment, everything to put on those jobs at the same time. And would also, those projects would be in different phases and would be having, you know, cash flow coming in from the various projects at different times and things like that. And well,
that it protects the public to have a guy with a $25,000 license limit sign 45 contracts that are under $25,000 doing them all at the same time. He obviously doesn't have the trucks, manpower, or cash to be able to do that.
Well, and some of that is the market will correct itself in that situation. And if the subcontractor can do it, that is contemplated by the statute, that a subcontractor could potentially do that, but that's very unlikely that they could. And what the legislature has put in place is that the risk of that actually happening and a subcontractor going out that has a $25,000 limit and getting 45 jobs at the same time that are all at the same phase and that they can't man is less likely than a subcontractor putting all of their eggs into one basket and becoming overextended on one job and then not getting paid and therefore not being able to pay its suppliers and employees.
I'm not sure that is an understanding of the real world. I bet you there's some landscaping contractors that have $10,000 limits that are doing houses all over Washoe County, all over the state for that matter, that collectively wouldn't even come close to their license limit. But anyway, I understand your point.
And the other thing that's always available is the one-time license limit increase on a permanent basis or for a project. So mm-hmm. Thank you very much again for allowing us to participate today.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to give you another 2 minutes. We chewed into your time pretty good, so I'll give you 2 minutes. You were responding to our questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start by addressing the financial considerations in the back and forth that just occurred. The legislature has delineated the financial metrics that go into determining a license limit. They're found in 624.263.2 sub A through F. And if we look through those, we see that primarily they're based on liquidity. Besides, you know, whether you've had a bankruptcy or something like that in the past, their current ratios, they're based on the current status of the entity. What's being argued to you today is that there is some public interest that is served by saying that a single contractor with a $50,000 limit can enter into 100 contracts for $50,000 to be performed at the exact same time, and that our statutory interpretation says that's okay, but the same contractor cannot do a series of sequential contracts for one person in a subdivision and have that be okay.
Well, doesn't that make sense though? From policy standpoint, they're arguing that it spreads the risk and protects the public.
It doesn't make sense, Your Honor, and here's why. Because when we're talking about sequential work and we're talking about the financial metrics that make up the basis for determining the license limit, we're in essence creating like a credit account. And so if the contractor has completed the job and everything is fine, why should they be punished for the future? Why should they be told, we don't care that you did great work for toll in that subdivision. We don't care that everything worked out great, everybody was paid. You still can't go back and work for that person again. We're actually punishing people forever. And if we start
Council,
looking...
Council, isn't that a policy argument for the legislature? Tell them, you know, this doesn't make sense to make this distinction?
It is a policy argument that needs to be brought up with the legislature, but it also plays into how we are deciding to interpret this statute that is vague. We have to think about the policy considerations. We cannot, based on our statutory construction rules, come up with an analysis that leads to absurd results. And that's exactly what happens here, Your Honor.
Sorry to interrupt you, but we keep running out of time. What are the categories of people or entities that you're saying are treated differently under your equal protection argument? Because I'm still not clear what that argument is.
For any monetary license amount, as between two licensees with the same monetary amount.
So subcontractors with limited licenses?
Yes, or my client with an unlimited license as a contractor is told who he can and cannot hire based on whether they have ever worked for him before.
What are the two categories that are treated differently then?
It's licensees. So licensees are treated differently.
Licensees are one group. So who's treated differently than who?
Within a group of licensees, they are treated differently based on either who they hire or who they work for.
So?
Because we're aggregating for some people, but not everybody. And here's the key, Your Honor. We are saying that for the $50,000 or $25,000 landscaper who enters into 100 different contracts for 100 different people, we're not going to aggregate for that person. But we are going to aggregate if that person, if all of that work was in the Double Diamond subdivision for Toll Brothers, then we're going to aggregate. So we are taking each licensee and treating them differently based on for whom they work or who they hire.
So let me ask you this. You mentioned Toll Brothers. And so is it okay for Toll Brothers, it's got projects throughout the city in different subdivisions, Double Diamond, Curdy Ranch. So he's got a carpet sub-trade that's working Double Diamond. And you're saying you can't work for the same contractor, but he's a contractor in Double Diamond, he's a contractor in... Curdy Ranch, is that okay? He just pluck him from Double Diamond, bring him over to Curdy Ranch, same contractor and same sub, is that okay?
So conceptually, under the analysis that the contractors board had put forth, if you take them out of one subdivision and put them in another subdivision, they could work in that subdivision until they've met their limit in that subdivision. And then both those subdivisions would be out forever. No temporal limitation on when they can go back into that subdivision and work for that contractor.
Well, that same ever. General contractor is doing the construction and hiring the subs, right? Because it only limits the same contractor from hiring them.
So it's client-based. Right. So it's for a single client. So Toll Brothers, as a developer, actually is right. Its own licensee, unlimited right. Licensee. And so they're out hiring the individual subcontractors, right? And so for each one of those subcontractors that gets hired by Toll, their client is Toll.
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Very interesting arguments. The briefing was very good. We sure appreciate it. And appreciate you showing up today. So this matter will stand submitted. The court will stand in recess until the next call of court.